KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome former President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton. And please welcome our panelists, Chairman of the Board, Grupo Carso, Mr. Carlos Slim. Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, News Corporation, Rupert Murdoch. General Colin L. Powell. President and Chief Executive Officer, Walmart, H. Lee Scott, Jr. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our moderator, Special Correspondent for NBC News, Tom Brokaw.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to begin with a few impressive commitments, which I will do as expeditiously as possible so our great panel can get to work. The first organization we recognize today is my neighbor in Westchester County, the Swiss Reinsurance Company. I'd like to ask the CEO, Shaka Grand, Roger Ferguson, Chairman and Executive Board Member, to come up. They, last year, you may remember, made the largest dollar commitment of any of the attendees at CGI for clean energy projects across Europe to do their part to reduce the threat of climate change. Today, Swiss Re makes a very interesting and innovative commitment which could be followed by virtually any company of any size on any continent. Swiss Re's new CO2 reduce and gain program will be launching in January, offering each employee of the company 5,000 Swiss francs, roughly $4,000 every 5 years to match any investment he or she makes to reduce the emissions that they individually cause. It's amazing. So that the company will match expenses that include buying a hybrid car, installing solar panels or heat pumps in the home. The program could also be used to pay for days that employers take off to work as volunteers in climate-related activities. If half the company's employees use the program, Swiss Re would be investing $5 million a year. So we urge their full participation. Eligible investments will vary from country to country, just as effective ways to reduce CO2 emissions vary with locations. Since 1980, solar panels have become 7 times less expensive per watt. In other words, their cost has dropped over 80%. New inventions and innovations are bringing those costs lower every year. There are some hybrid cars already that can get more than 50 miles a gallon. Heat pumps cost less to operate than all other types of heating systems. And we've already talked about the savings that are available from more efficient lighting. So as far as I know, this is the first company that has offered its employees financial incentives to reduce their own individual contributions to climate change. It's quite an advance, and I thank them very much. Let's give them a hand. You both are shining. Now I'd like to ask Margaret McGlynn, the president of Merck Vaccines, of Merck Pharmaceuticals, and Margarita Gurdian Lopez, the Minister of Health from the Ministry of Health in Nicaragua, to come forward.
Hello.
morning, Mr. Clinton. So nice to meet you.
This is a commitment by Merck to introduce rotavirus vaccine in Nicaragua, creating a new model to accelerate vaccine access in low-income countries. It is a $75 million commitment over 3 years to vaccinate every child born in Nicaragua against rotavirus, a common cause of severe diarrhea among children. And let me just reiterate the facts here. 1 in 4 of all deaths on Earth are from AIDS, TB, malaria, and infections from dirty water, including cholera, dysentery, but the largest category is diarrhea. 80% of the people who die are under 5 years of age. So this is a very, very important commitment. As part of this 3-year partnership for the government of Nicaragua, Merck is going to give an estimated 1.5 million doses of its Rotatec vaccine for free, and hopes that this vaccine program will be a model of how to introduce new vaccines around the world in the future. This could help us all. The Gates Foundation, for example, and others are spending an enormous amount of money to revitalize the efforts to seek an AIDS vaccine, and we need to know how best to do this among children. It is responsible, rotavirus, for the deaths of 600,000 children aged 5 or younger every year, 80% of them in developing countries, 15,000 in Latin America. So, they are going to reduce the 1,400 children who die from this every single day. And I am very grateful to them. So let's give them a big hand. This is great. Thank you. Thanks so much. Now I'd like to ask Pam Obenyar, the founder of Humanity United, and Randy Newcomb, its executive director, to come up. They are doing a project with the Center for American Progress and the International Crisis Group. Humanity United will partner with the Center for American Progress and the International Crisis Group, both grassroots organizations, and key analysts to mount a comprehensive nationwide campaign to end mass atrocities worldwide, in particular in East Africa. I want to personally thank Pam for her commitment on these issues. And all the many times that she has talked to me in stern terms about our obligations to do more in Darfur and elsewhere, this is more than a passing interest. They will bring broad-based, nonpartisan, diverse, and creative advocacy to policymakers and decision-makers in America and other countries to develop strategies to increase preventive measures against crimes against humanity and make relief immediately available when regions face extreme violence. Sudan and Kenya continue to suffer from ongoing civil conflicts, and there have been many, many others in Africa in recent years. So I think that we can safely say that someone needs to do something to raise not only public awareness but determination that leads us to a more systematic response so that we can respond to these kinds of things in a more timely fashion. Pam Omidyar founded Humanity United in 2005 as a catalyst to end human suffering caused by mass atrocity, and this is a big first public step for them to do something that I think has the chance, if the rest of us help them, to change the way policy is made in America and throughout the world. Let's give them a big hand. Thank you. I'd like to now invite to the stage Martin Sullivan, the President and CEO of the American International Group, AIG, and Maria Otero, the President and CEO of Acción. Their commitment is to fund 30 microfinance institutions to provide more than 1 million poor entrepreneurs with innovative financial products like housing loans, insurance, savings, and remittances. And they will also establish the AIG Prize for Microfinance Innovation to reward institutions that devise new and successful products and delivery measures in microfinance, sponsoring Acción's financial literacy program, which will deliver no fewer than 450,000 courses in business development and financial literacy. AIG and Acción believe the next major step in microfinance is a shift from credit-driven to demand-driven institutions that focus on what clients need. In spite of the explosion in microcredit in the last 10 to 15 years, 80% of the world's population still has no access to credit. And 500 to 600 million people we know by today's commonly used criteria are eligible for it who do not have any access. So this is very exciting. If you think about the fact that the World Bank now estimates that there are over 7,000 microfinance institutions that serve about 16 million poor people with an annual turnover of about $2.5 billion, the fact that at this conference we have had commitments that in the aggregate will add millions and millions of people to the ranks of those eligible for microfinance. This is one area when you go home and they say, what did you do to change the shape of things, you can say that we've had in 1 3-day period, we have a substantial increase in the base of people all across the world eligible for microfinance. And we should be grateful to AIG and Acción for their role in doing that. Now, I would like to ask Vinod Khosla, Jim Wolfenson, Ron Burkle, and Steve Bing to come forward. All these four people are good friends of mine, and I have to say something very personal about the advance of CGI. As far as I know, this is the first time in his adult lifetime that Ron Burkle has worn a tie 3 days in a row. Steve Bing did buy me a tie for my birthday. And Vinod Khosla has now become the world's international authority on the most fashionable way not to wear a tie. Wolfitz and I were just two gray-haired guys in suits. I want to say that these men represent a commitment that also includes my personal involvement to do something to raise substantial funds to make green investments. Climate change already contributes to 150,000 deaths a year. The United States, in spite of the growth of China, India, and other countries, with only 4% of the world's population, still contributes 22% of its carbon emissions. We know that if we reduced emissions 50% by 2010, 75% by 2015, 85% by 2020, just of diesel fine particle emissions, we could save 100,000 lives between now and 2030 in this country alone. So what we're going to do is to team up to pursue clean, renewable energy sources, new conservation technologies, and try to raise as much money as we can to finance a significant reduction in dependence on fossil fuels and create more jobs, not only in the United States and in other developed countries, but in the developing countries as well. We have to be able to prove that there are economically viable ways for countries to get rich and avoid the greenhouse gas path that we took. So I thank particularly Vinod Khosla for his unbelievable passion in the area of biofuels and developing a green future. And I thank my friends for joining me with him to try to raise the funds necessary to make this transition much, much more quickly. So let's give him a hand. And Mr. Khosla, you begin. You're the enforcer. I would like to say a special word of thanks to this extraordinary group of panelists that have joined us today. And I'm indebted to many of them for many things, but a lot of the specific things they will talk about today. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank Rupert Murdoch and his unusual partner, Barbara Streisand, for funding my foundation's efforts to help. We now have 32 of the 40 largest cities in the world signed up to make a joint effort to have a major reduction in their greenhouse gas emissions. And we couldn't be doing this work if it weren't for him. And thank you, Rupert. Thank you, Barbara. Let's get on with the program. Let's go.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Tom Brokaw. I'm very happy to be here. If you believe, as I do, that a lot of life is like high school, this is not a bad cafeteria that we're assembled in here this morning. And I'm not sure how I got to such a cool table as we have assembled here on the stage tonight. Most of you know who these people are, so we're going to move right into the discussion. And we hope that during the course of the next hour or so, we can help ourselves and help all of you find new ways of dealing with this much smaller planet on which we're all living, where there are more people and disappearing resources. As I travel the world, I am so acutely conscious now of how many traditional boundaries have dissolved or have been lowered. I'm acutely conscious of the seismic shifts in political and economic power, and I'm extremely aware of the fact that no government can do it all when it comes to the needs that we have economically in terms of social responsibility and our natural resources. And very rapidly filling that gap, of course, are NGOs and the private sector. When I left Nightly News, I joined the Board of Overseers of the International Rescue Committee, which is kind of the gold standard in dealing with refugees around the world. Since 1996, our budget has gone up 300%, and we now have 13,000 people around the world. We've been dealing not just with the traditional problems in Africa, but with new refugee crises in Lebanon and Afghanistan and Pakistan and in the tsunami region. That's just one tiny snapshot of the challenges that are before us here today. So I'd like to begin by asking our distinguished panelist, Colin Powell, who has worn so many hats as a commander of troops on the ground, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, occupying the National Security Office in the White House, and of course, the Secretary of State, whether we need a new model or to be thinking about that, about the interface between government, private sector, and the NGOs.
Thank you, Tom. It's a great pleasure to be here with you this morning and with these distinguished panelists. I think a new model has emerged that we're trying to catch up with. When I think about my life in government and most of those years as a soldier, the world that I knew and the battlefields I worried about, whether it was a Cold War battlefield in Europe or the hot wars that I was involved in Asia, all of that has fundamentally changed, and all of the political, cultural, social, and other kind of boundaries that we used to have just 15 or 20 years ago that segregated the world into the red side of the map, the blue side of the map, not only segregated us with respect to the ideological systems we believed in, but segregated us with respect to economic activity. The kinds of things that we are doing now, the sorts of things we are talking about now, were impossible just 15, 20 years ago. 20 years ago, right now, I was a corps commander in Germany. I had the narrowest section of the NATO front. It was my job to stop the Russian 8th Guards Army if it ever came through. And if a plane ever approached Frankfurt from that direction coming from Prague, I would engage it with Hawk missiles. That was just 20 years ago. And I watched all of that collapse. I watched all of that come down. I'll never forget the day that Gorbachev looked me in the eye, sitting in the Kremlin, and with a smile on his face, said to me, "General, General, I'm so very, very sorry, but you will have to find a new enemy." And as a professional soldier, I thought to myself at that moment, I don't want to. I like this enemy. You know, life is simple. We got our product, you know, products in place. We got our market share allocated. Just because you're having a bad year, why should the rest of us have to change? But he was having a bad century. And so it all changed. And several things happened. Iron Curtain came down. Germany unified itself. Suddenly, trade began back and forth. You just heard samples of it in the last few minutes and in the course of the last day or two. China discovered that it was getting nowhere with Mao's little red book, and so Deng Xiaoping came along and said, "I no longer care if it's a black cat or a white cat as long as it catches mice," meaning it's irrelevant whether it's a communist economic model or a capitalist economic model. The only thing that counts is, does it catch mice? Does it create wealth? Both in China and in the Soviet Union, the realization came about that they couldn't have both guns and butter, and so both of those systems had to fundamentally change. And when they changed, enormous new opportunities opened up for trade, for investment. These nations knew, as did other nations in the world watching all of this take place, that it really was democracy that worked. It really was the market economic system that worked. And great opportunities were created for businesses represented on the stage and represented throughout this audience. What can those businesses do? What is their role? What is the nature of the partnership they should have with the governments of the countries that they're going to do business in? First of all, the most important contribution that a business makes to the country that it is going to do business in is not philanthropy. It's to create jobs for the people in that country so that on a Friday evening they can bring home a paycheck and bring dignity into the home and demonstrate to their fellow citizens the value of hard work and the value of allowing investment to come into the country. The other thing that businesses do when they go into these countries is they pay taxes, which contributes to the economic well-being of that society. The most important thing that businesses do when they go into these countries is to generate a profit for themselves. And all of that other stuff that we're going to talk about with respect to philanthropy will only come about if businesses are developing a profit, creating a profit for themselves. That means they have to go places where the rule of law exists, where there are high standards of corporate governance, where commercial law exists, where there is recourse to law when commercial disputes come along. They have to go to places that are now friendly toward business. Capital, as we know, is a coward. It will go only where it can be safe. And more nations are realizing that. And so a new model was created, and we have moved from the battlefields of my youth to playing fields. And I think one of the most important playing fields that we have to think about is the economic playing field. When you see the emergence of the Eastern European and Central Asian nations that are trying to develop economies that work in this 21st century world, when you see what China's doing, when you see what India has done to become a strategic partner of the United States of America, when you see how the World Trading Organization has exploded, when you see how China decided that the way to assault the United States is not with Little Red Book and ideology, but to filling Walmart stores with their products and making sure we buy those products. And when we run out of money to buy those products, the Chinese are lending us the money to buy their products. They have gotten very, very smart with respect to how this world is working. As a result of this fantastic change in moving on to economic playing fields, even though there are still some ugly battlefields out there, more people are living under democracy than any time in history. More nations are democratically led than at any time in history, and there are fewer wars than any time in the last 50 years, creating more opportunity for trade and investment and business. What I have been so pleased to see is that as American companies go overseas and generate profit and create jobs and pay taxes, they realize they have a greater obligation to those societies. And I have seen them meet those obligations, whether it is making sure that they are training a skilled workforce, so infusing that society with the skills of modern business and modern industrial practice. They bring with them labor standards that don't immediately take root throughout the country, but give an example to the country of how you have to protect labor. They start to work on the health needs and the health care of their employees. They start to invest in the infrastructure of the country in which they are working. So the private sector, working with government sector, working with NGOs, working with international organizations, have an important role to play as we move the world further into the 21st century. This globalized world, this world that is flattening, this world that is being driven by the information revolution, all of these things come together and give us new opportunities to help the people of the world. The best illustration of this is what you have heard over the last 2 days with respect to commitment. Just listen to the kinds of things you've heard about, and how the companies and other leaders who have come forward and stood on the stage over the last 2 or 3 days have shown you and illustrated to you and demonstrated to you how they can make a contribution to solving mankind's problems. In the State Department, I found in the 4 years that I was there that we have a good understanding of this, and increasingly it is our economic counselors in our embassies that have more work to do than the military attachés or anyone else. And this is as it should be. Under the leadership of my distinguished predecessor, Madeleine Albright, who is here with us today, beginning in 1999, we started to recognize from the State Department those companies that are making major contributions in the countries in which they do business. And we get about 100 applications every year for these awards. And it is a source of great pleasure for any Secretary of State to stand up there and recognize companies who are investing in all of the things I've talked about. So the new model that is out there is a model that began with the end of the Cold War, with the realization in China that they had to change their economic system, and with all that has happened over the last 15 or 20 years. I think it's a model that is in progress. It's going to continue to evolve. It's going to require partnerships between the private sector and government. It's going to require the support of the United States government as we go forward. But I think we have the potential to make this a much better world, to improve the health of the world, to eliminate poverty in the world, to make sure we're investing in infrastructure in the world, to educate the young people of the world, to give those developing nations of the world the kind of skill sets and the kind of infrastructure that they need to be successful in this 21st century world. So the model has changed, and I'm glad that everybody here understands that changed model, and we're all working together to keep the world moving forward, to improve the lives of our fellow citizens throughout the world, and to prepare a next generation of leaders among the young people of the world.
Mr. Secretary, thank you. That gives us a very good tour of the horizon and a working overview. Now let's see if we can't get at some specific issues. Rupert Murdoch, you're the most powerful media baron in the history of our business. You cover the waterfront. Print, electronic, satellite, the blogosphere. The old rule used to be print the news and raise hell and let others worry about social issues. Is it possible to have the kind of power that you do in this information technological age and still be a global citizen, or is that a difficult intersection for you to work your way through in your business? You have to pick up the microphone, Rupert.
I'll ignore your exaggerated introduction, but of course we should be advocating. You said we used to raise hell. We've got to raise hell about the issues that matter, and we do. And it's a very, very important role for us to be advocates, advocates with our readers, advocates with our own staff. For instance, when there are big natural disasters or unnatural disasters, like the shooting in Beslan, we immediately appeal to all our readers to give money for relief, and we match that amount of money. There are many, many things we can do at that level. But I think our role also, we've got to remember we're a large public company with 100,000 shareholders. Our job as directors are trustees for those 100,000 people. So there are limits to what we can do. But if it's making our company a better company, making our employees better citizens, that's fine. For instance, in London, we appealed to the journalists on the Times to go out and teach reading to the thousands of Bangladeshi migrants who live within 3 miles of our printing plant. We got twice as many volunteers as we could possibly handle. But half of them go out now every day teaching reading to the Bangladeshi immigrants who are pouring into London. That's the sort of thing we do to make our staff aware, to be better citizens, to do everything we can. There are things on a bigger global stage we try to do, such as, let's take climate change for one thing, that we've made a gift here to President Clinton. We have actually done something real in London with B Sky B. I found about it afterwards. My son did it. But as a result, we're going to put it right through the company. We've said we're going to be absolutely carbon neutral. This is a company employing thousands of people. We think it does a lot for the reputation of the company. It improves its image. It makes it more valuable. That's good for the shareholders, too. But it's good for the society. We're going thousands, well, it's only hundreds of little initiatives that all add up and are all amassed, whether it's changing from a taxi company to one that only uses non-carbon fuels. We subsidize every employee $2,000 who will buy a hybrid car. We are looking at everything we do, our suppliers, everything they supply to us, what boxes or whatever, what fuels are they using, what are they doing. And then where we will fall short at the end, we're committed to put in, you know, a wind farm or forests in certain parts of the world to make up the difference. We are doing that, and we're now examining whether we can do it across the world for our whole company in every country in which we operate. If I could just come back for a minute to the advocacy piece, you know, a thing like Star in India. We've done a tremendous job on our 7 television channels there to make people aware of the danger of HIV and have been in that. Other things like, we're just about with MySpace, with over 100,000 registrants. We're appealing to them to make them more aware and to give to the victims of the civil war in Darfur. And it goes on and on and on. We can do many, many things. They're not multi-billion gifts, but maybe they're more valuable. We're even developing, we're in a group, I'll just shut up in a minute, but we put this last night, we're trying to get a $100 computer made which can go into every desk of every child in the world. We've got the cost down to something very close to that. Now, it's pretty unpopular with certain well-known people at this conference, but we've achieved it, and it's going to be going out already. Major nations in Africa are buying into it. Brazil is buying into it. And this is a computer which will have Wi-Fi on it. It will have a camera in it, have every high-tech thing you can think of. And every child should be able to get one of these on their desk wherever they are in the world to bring them into the new age. We think that's a very important thing. Ourselves, Google, AMD, about six companies. We're doing this with Boston MIT.
Will that computer have a key on it that will take him automatically to page 6?
I wish.
Lee Scott, you grew up in the American heartland.
Sorry.
And arrived at Walmart as a truck driver. Now you're steering it in new directions. You're known as the man who's turning Walmart much more into a green retailer and a green presence in this country. How much of that was driven by social protest against what Walmart represented in this country?
Oh, I'd say very little was driven by specific criticism on our actions within the environment. I think as a company, we've gone through a transformation as we have become a larger company and have grappled with understanding what is our role beyond the business model and the products that we sell to our customers and the savings that we provide. I would say, General Powell, that it would be substantially less than 25% of those would actually have come from China. We didn't know how to interact with the NGOs. And, you know, to the question that you asked previously, the issues that are facing this world, this country and this world, are greater than what government itself can solve. And they are greater than what businesses can solve. And in many cases, NGOs simply do not have the power to resolve the issues. What we have done that has been the most successful is as we have reached out and built alliances, both with governments, but specifically with NGOs who have technical skills and technical knowledge that did not reside within Walmart, we have convinced them that we really care and we want to do the right thing. What has happened is they've learned about our business, we've learned about them, and what we've done is arrive at the intersection point where these opportunities also match with great business opportunities. So if you think about something as simple as compact fluorescent light bulbs, by working with General Electric and Jeff Immelt and I working together and our teams working together and working with National Resource Defense and Environmental Defense and other groups, we have a plan in place right now we're working on to sell 100 million compact fluorescent light bulbs, which are profitable for General Electric, profitable for Walmart, and would save, if we do that, we'll save 1.5 power plants. And all of a sudden, your size, if you can harness your size and your relationships, and if the NGOs will trust that your motives aren't always evil, then you can make partnerships that take these things beyond anything you would have dreamed of. And the last thing I'd say on this is we did this because we thought there's a great business opportunity to eliminate waste and to grow our business. What I did not recognize is how it would excite our associates. It would give them a common bond and a common purpose that is beyond the transaction of simply, you know, our philosophy of saving consumers money. It's a higher purpose, and it has been embraced and driven through the company.
Carlos Slim, you're the most powerful man in Central and South America. You've created an enormous telecommunications empire and retail empire. And at the same time, you've been the greatest philanthropist that your country has ever known. One of your foundations has $3 billion. You're doing everything from education to health care. But what happens when you, as we all do at some point, go away? This is a personal commitment that you have made. How can we be sure that these kinds of foundations and these kinds of commitments that are made in the private sector have lasting power and that it doesn't take the responsibility away from the governments so that they say, well, Carlos is doing that. I don't have to worry about it.
Good morning. First, I want to grateful President Clinton for his invitation. I think that's the way to address the global problems. And let me disagree with the adjective you gave me. I think that business community should get very deep involved in the solution of the global problems, especially poverty. I think that to fight poverty is also a very good investment. It's the best investment from the social, political, and economical side. Poverty is not just a problem like it was in the agricultural civilization, a problem of ethics, a moral problem, or a problem of social justice. It's an economic need. And we had seen in the last 50 years that trillions of dollars has been go to try to solve the problem, and the problem is still there and very strong. I believe that the only way to solve this problem is with education and employment. And we had seen how many countries in the last 20 years has taken out from poverty hundreds of millions of people. Hundreds of millions of people, and the countries has also, that is very important, get out of underdeveloped. We had seen that first in Korea, but we also saw it in Spain, in Portugal, Greece, all the Soviet Union countries that are growing strongly and going to get developed, but also in Asia. And the last examples and the strong examples is China, India, how they are going to modernity, coming from an agricultural society of 1,000 years old, and come gradually but very fast, growing more than 10%, and I think they will grow on this amounts in the next maybe 50 or 30 years, taking people out of poverty and very primitive economy with auto-consumption and getting them involved in the new society. The development of the countries come from agricultural countries and rural countries going urban and industrial in the past. And now they are making a leapfrog, coming from a very old economic agricultural society to a very modern society with high technology, education, etc. That's what we want to do in Latin America. We are 500 million people in Latin America. Many of us, when many of the population has problems of health, nutrition, education. And we need to move in education from alphabetization to digital culture to superior studies. And that's what we think is very important to us. By the other way, we believe, and that's the point in this conference, that it's not giving how you solve the problems. Is trying to solve the problems permanently, not only rely of the local problems, but to look it to solve permanently. To solve it permanently, you need to have, like I was telling, education and employment. And when you talk about employment, you need to talk about employers who give the employment. And for that, and we have very good examples yesterday, is business, the business communities who give the employment. It will not be solved the problem with 50-80% of the population being bureaucrats. You need to give employment, and the employers are in the business community, especially in the micro, small, and medium business enterprise. Because what you need to do is to have investment, to develop human capital, human and physical capital. What's human capital? Nutrition of the mother pregnant, health of the child, nutrition of the boy the first 2 years, especially health and education, high education and the cultural, digital culture, modernize and quality for the education is very important. Because with the better education, you have better jobs. And good jobs articulate families, articulate societies, and articulate countries.
Do you think that your model can encourage more North American-based companies to make greater investments in South America and in Central America? And should there be more dialogue at the private sector level about the issue of job creation and the issue in this country, especially, of illegal immigration?
Well, first, I think that your country also need to address poverty, because you have a lot of people out of modernity that you need to educate and give jobs to them. And I think that's an issue also for North America. But now what I believe is that there are thousands of needs and projects and billions of money and dollars in the market, in the money market, the capital market, all the markets. What we need is to put together the needs with the money. And that's what we are trying to address now with my new activity. I left my boards. I left the boards of the companies I am in, I used to be in. And we are trying to push the development and employment with two combinations. First, I was telling that it's profitable. I think that we need to have a war against poverty. And I believe that you need two kinds of combinations. First, it is profitable to invest in education, to invest in health, to invest in infrastructure, in housing, in telecommunications, power, roads, water supply and treatment and sewage. Everything can be profitable. That's one side. And in the other side, for the things that are not profitable, we have the foundation. We believe that the combination of a business-oriented company with the foundations, you can address the problems. Let's say medicine research, technology research, science and development is not profitable. You make in the foundation. So you can support some hospitals, health problems, education problems that are not profitable through this way. But also, and that's my last point, talking about the question you make to General Powell, we are sure that there is a limit in the budget, in the public budget, always, especially in our countries. There is a big limit to public investment. Then you need to make a combination between public investment and private investment. Not necessarily privatization. Public services financed by private investment.
Lee Scott, what happens if a Chinese Walmart develops and comes right after your pricing policy? And how committed are you then to, for example, the green movement, and how responsible will you be to the continuing pressure on you about wages and benefits for your employees if, as could very well happen in this new global economy, we suddenly find retail empire coming up from Mexico or from Singapore or from China, going right after what has always been your great strength, which is your service and pricing policy?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to be driven by a philosophy and not by rules. And Carlos is talking about Central and South America, and you're talking about China. The truth is Walmart's program has been embraced as well, if not better, outside the United States than it has been inside. I was amazed when I traveled to our stores in Costa Rica and found out how much further ahead they were than we are in things like sustainable fisheries and those areas. So, you know, you have a basic philosophy that you follow, and then you have certain rules. And it doesn't matter what country we are in, there are corporate governance rules that have to be applied, and you simply have to have people who operate within the boundaries that we as a company operate within. Doesn't matter if it is suppliers or if it is our own store. So I don't, interestingly enough, Tom, at our stage in this, we're not finding that there are trade-offs. Do you have to do less business? Do you have to sell for less? Do you sell for more? Are there these trade-offs? What we're finding is there's so much low-hanging fruit that you're eliminating waste. You're making the company a better company. You actually are able to lower prices. You're able to treat your customer, and our customer is that base customer in any country, is the predominance of our customer base. they need to save money. And so as you can lower the price of something like those compact fluorescents, all of a sudden people who couldn't afford to participate in sustainability, they can now afford to and make it part of their lifestyle and improve their standard of living. So, if somebody comes in and cheats and cuts corners and sells for less than we do, the likelihood is they're not going to be around. And so we stay the course, and if we have to make less profit to compete, we'll make less profit. But we're not going to debase our principles to be competitive.
Tell me about the motivation for selling $4 generic drugs.
Oh, I just thought it's the coolest thing. it's self-serving in some ways because Walmart sells for less. And that's why people get in their car and don't go shopping. We have 176 million people a week shop at our stores, which is a pretty good number. And they get in their car to go to Walmart. And they go to save money and because of the assortment and because of the associates. The one area that we have not been able to attack, and we have a very low market share, is in drugs, in pharmacy. And it's because price hasn't mattered because so many people have insurance. And yet, if you start looking at it and you really get involved, and President Clinton and I have had a number of conversations about this, the poorest people in our society don't take their maintenance drugs because they can't afford them. And yet, when you look at the margins in the drug business, they're really very healthy. And so we have a young person that we hired who came in, and we challenged him to put price back into the equation to drive our business and send a message to our customer that we're on their side. He came to us last week on Wednesday, I think it was, and said, we can lower the price on 291 prescription drugs, generic drugs, to $4, period. And anybody can walk in with a doctor's prescription and buy those for $4. And we as a company, we're going to, if that's all we sell, we're going to lose some money. But we think it'll drive enough traffic and it'll send a strong message out there that, by golly, if you want to save money on prescription drugs, Walmart's the place to shop. And it'll show the customer that we're on their side in this battle for health costs that are affordable. And so we said, it's about a five-minute discussion. We said, let's do it. And I think, many people will match us. There will be a lot of customers who won't switch. But the one thing that will always be true is that Walmart stores is the one that took generic drug prices on 291 prescription drugs to $4. And people are going to save money, and it's going to improve people's lives because they will be on high blood pressure medicine that they wouldn't have.
General Powell, a lot of these developments are market-driven and have grown up in kind of an ad hoc fashion. But what happens if the private sector and the NGO drive begins to conflict with the policy of an administration or what a president or chief executive, not just in this country, but in any of the Western countries, says, this is not the direction in which I want to go? How does that get resolved?
Well, I think it gets resolved through conversations and dialogue and negotiations between the two parties. But I don't really see that as a real problem, Tom. I sense that policy in the administrations that I've worked in over the last 10 or 15 years have been to encourage this kind of activity. To pick up on one point that Lee made earlier, and I've seen this in my own work with nonprofit organizations, but you really want to get buy-in with your employees. Employees want to be part of a good organization. They want to be part of a company or that people speak highly of. And so when they see that their company does things such as $4 generic drugs or is helping with HIV/AIDS, they feel better about themselves, they feel better about being an employee, and that pays off. That is a benefit to the company over time. The other thing I would say is that to do this well, you have to be prepared to do it on a sustained, persistent basis and not just giving money, not just creating a foundation that flows money out and you check it every now and again. I think the best programs are those that get complete employee involvement at every level so they feel they're a part of it. And everybody realizes we are in this for the long run and not just to get an award from the State Department and not just for the purpose of making ourselves look good, but because it's the right thing to do and it becomes part of the corporate philosophy of the company. I think those are the ones that give you the most successful programs.
At News Corp, Rupert, have you, in the last 10 years or so, and your foundation and how you give and what you give and the programs that you develop, I happen to know some of the people who are directly involved in News Corporation, has that become an enormously more important part of News Corporation and something that you pay more attention to, the structure of it and the long-term goal of it, the business plan, if you will, addressing the foundation and the philanthropic side of News Corp, has that become as important to you in many ways as the pure business side?
Well, sure, but you can't do it unless you have the pure business side in good order.
Right.
I believe in entirely what Colin just said. People want to feel proud of who they're working for or what company they're involved with and feel part of it. And they want to feel they're being good citizens and they can talk to other people about it. And I think, we've learned a lot today. I think we've seen how far things have progressed in the last few years. It's the market system, to some extent, working very well because people see this is good business.
Has that been a surprise to you? Has that come to you a little bit late in your business life, in your business career?
No, but I keep having it reinforced.
In driving that.
The other thing it does, Tom, if I can, when people around the world see American companies come into their countries and take this kind of responsibility, it says something about America. We worry about our image around the world. We worry about public diplomacy. And you're not going to solve our image problem or our public diplomacy problem with public diplomacy programs and plans. You're going to solve it with this kind of activity where people can see what America stands for. We stand for labor standards. We stand for health standards. We want to invest responsibly in a company. We are making money, but we are serving the society in which we are doing business. And that says a lot about who we are. The reverse of that is to make sure that we have good policies that allow people to come to this country and go to our universities, go to our hospitals, live amongst us, and learn more about what America is truly all about. So with this kind of activity, we are giving the best public diplomacy message we can to the rest of the world.
Lee Scott, I've already read that some critics, not by name so far, but they may emerge at some point, shareholder groups and others say, oh, wait a minute, we've been through this before. We had the Made in USA campaign that Sam had. That didn't work out as well for us as just buying wherever we could as cheaply as we could. Are you beginning to feel pressure from your shareholders and from analysts about the direction in which you're taking the company?
No. We are very fortunate at Walmart in that we have a single family that controls a significant portion of the stock. That family is certainly interested, as all families are, in shareholders in having, dividends and share price increase. But what they're most interested in is creating a company that their father, Sam Walton, would be proud of. We just finished a two-day board meeting. We went through the five-year plans. We went through all those normal things. But in our board, we talk a lot about the culture. We talk about sustainability. We talk about, from a lens of 20 years from now, will the people who, that next generation of Waltons, will they look back and value what we did as the right thing to build an enduring company? And so there's a balance that you always have to have. But we don't have criticism from our shareholders for what we're doing, because what we're doing is not saying we're going to take shareholder dollars and just simply pass it around in a public relations image campaign. What we're doing is fundamentally changing the way that we do business. And because we have such a large footprint, I mean, we have 1,800,000 employees, which we call associates. We have 50,000 factories that we deal with. People as great as 3M, Mo Navari was in my office last week, who's executive vice president of 3M, They read the speech that we gave at Walmart after Katrina and our efforts in Katrina, which caused us to understand that our size can, in fact, be used in a way that propels good. And Mo said they read that speech, and even though 3M is already an environmental leader and a company that is well worth admiring, they went back and redoubled their efforts on any number of areas because they knew their major customer was going to be looking at that. I got to tell you, before we started this, I had no idea. I think NGOs thought Walmart had more power than we thought we did. And that's, in many cases, the businesses, if you will just ask, not, you don't even at this point have to demand, if you will just ask, what are you doing as a supplier? It is unbelievable the positive impact you can have across any number of subjects.
You and I talked about this earlier. Do you have a specific anecdote in which doing the right thing is also unexpectedly good for business? I used for you the example of my friend Yvonne Chouinard, who runs Patagonia, and it's been a green company for a long time. They didn't like the packaging on their underwear. We're getting down to fundamentals here, folks. And Yvonne was told, you cannot sell underwear unless you put it in very fancy packaging. It's very costly. He said, how about a rubber band around the underwear? A rubber band, and that's all, with a little tiny tag telling you how much it cost and what the size was. I think their underwear sales went up by a factor of 300%.
Yeah, we are. Actually, since our conversation, we're now studying that. We wouldn't, of course, have an exact copy, but something similar.
Rupert, does the tax structure of this country have to be changed to encourage more of that and to reward it in ways that it's now being rewarded, the role of the private sector in philanthropy and doing a lot of the work that the government traditionally has done in the past, not only within these borders but outside these borders as well? Does that have to be a part of the examination that we're making as we go forward into this new world?
I don't think so. I'm not an expert on that, but my understanding is that certainly 90% of the giving that we do is tax deductible. And I don't think you can ask the government to do any more than pay half of it, which is the effect, the net effect of it. We hear about these great gifts, but in fact, in most cases, in most countries, the government's in fact paying for half of it.
This is a very philanthropic culture in North America. You are an extraordinary example in your country. The work that you've been doing, Carlos Slim, is it had a radiant effect among your fellow businessmen and friends who are also very powerful in Mexico in terms of making them think about what they want to do. I'll give you one good example. I have a friend in Chile who's an American who's gone down there and has done a lot with land preservation and conservation. And there was great resistance to the idea at first. He was a North American, but he loved the land. And now that they've seen how successful he is, other Chilean entrepreneurs, nationals in that country, are going to him and seeing the model and saying, what can we do? Will you help us? We want to do it on our own, but we need your guidance. Do Mexican and other Central American businessmen come to you and say, help me out here?
Sure, and I should say that about our foundations is not my compromise, it's a familiar compromise, and a very long-term compromise to make it as big as we need to make it. And there are many foundations, not in Mexico, but in Latin America. In Mexico, we can count some of them from the 20s. And like in U.S., many of them were oriented only to museums, art, collection, culture. But now it's very clear for everyone in all Latin America, with the strong foundations, that we need to address other problems, that the problem of poverty and development and the challenge we have there is the profile of the entrepreneur more than the politicians.
General Paul, it seems to me that one of the impressions that we ought to leave with this audience is that this is a long, complex, organic commitment that must be made, because these problems took a long time coming and they're not going to go away soon.
They've been a long time coming. It's going to take a long time to resolve them. And so I would say that we should keep encouraging companies to move in this direction, but also encourage them to make that kind of long-term commitment. Don't just donate computers to some school somewhere and say, gee, I've done my duty and I got a nice tax write-off. If you're not going to also put in place the education system, the training system, the maintenance system, the software updates, and all the rest of it, you really haven't done anything except make yourself look good in a one-time event. And so we can do a lot more. And I think as long as and along with what Lee said, as long as the company itself sees the benefit, either on the bottom line or goodwill, or the employees feel good about what they're doing, then more companies will get involved. We need to get more trade associations involved. When you deal with a trade association, you get a lot of companies all at once that might get involved. So I think we ought to engage trade associations more to generate more interest on the part of companies. It has to be persistent. It has to be a persevering commitment where they stick with it and don't turn away as soon as they think they've milked it for all the public relations benefit they can get from it.
General Powell? Yeah, to me, it's we've talked about sustainability. There are people in this room who are dealing with issues that are not as broad-based and more difficult in human life than what we're dealing with. The progress we're making in sustainability is actually what I would describe as fun. It is a fun part of the job. There are other parts that I think are important, like when a Walmart store or a retailer opens in China, and setting the standard for sanitation, setting the standard for paying taxes, same in Central America or other countries in South America, setting the business standards and then promoting people within those countries to run those countries, not doing that with expats, but creating the business skills and the work climate that allow what Carlos is talking about, and Rupert, and what General Powell are talking about, allowing those things then to become part of that business culture. You can't change an entire country, but you can sure change, in our case, the suppliers we deal with in a country when they know that we're not going to be a part of corruption. When we buy a piece of land and we're not going to be a part of corruption, we can set a standard that I think becomes helpful as countries try to fundamentally change their way of doing business, which those ways of doing business that are corrupt, I believe, are directly related to poverty.
Well, I think that the business community is very important. The corporations are important to get involved, and the executives have also this compromise. But I think that is more on, also on the side of entrepreneur and investors, not only the corporations, but the stockholders, the entrepreneurs, and the investors should do that also. Thank you.
Let me end on this note with just a question. One of my concerns has been the kinds of people that we're able to attract to the public sector. We have a clear demonstration here of the imaginative minds and the high standards of the people who are in the private sector. Do you think that there's some possibility, General Powell, that out of this renewed interest in the private sector and the NGOs, the people will begin to think about going back to Washington and getting involved in government as well, as they did in the 50s and the 60s, and then there has been a kind of halt to all of it?
I certainly hope so. I mean, we are always looking for great people to come into the Foreign Service, and I think all government agencies are looking for the best people. I'm pleased to say that in recent years in the Foreign Service, we have seen renewed interest on the part of young Americans. A lot of those who have worked overseas and have seen the problems have done their share in corporate life, and they've done reasonably well, but now they want to get back at a different level. They want to set policy, or they want to be involved at a different level, and they're coming back and joining the Foreign Service. And I think other government departments are seeing that. So I think we can see it both ways. I hope a lot of the people who leave the Foreign Service will want to go then into the private sector and make their contribution as well. So, yes, Tom, I think this is a way to generate new interest in serving the public.
Any of your key executives talk about wanting to go to Washington, Lee?
No. But I have worked with a number of Rupert's people, and I will tell you that I know he is good, but one of the keys is he has a great team, and he has a number of people that I would recommend to go to Washington.
But is it?
They're not available.
All right.
But that's an issue. That's a concern. The fact is that you can't let atrophy occur at the public level as well, Rupert. If you have good people, should you in a corporation as a part of this commitment that you're making, talk to people who work for you about giving back in the public sector as well and serving in Washington in some capacity?
Oh, yes. I was joking. And I think a lot of our best people would treat it as a great honor. If at some stage of their career they're invited to go to Washington and serve, and we would certainly always welcome them back afterwards.
And there are many who do. I mean, immediately come to mind Hank Paulson, those who can afford to go into public service. And frankly, public service at a senior level has been made much more difficult over the last 20 or 30 years, Tom, with the disclosure requirements and the process you have to go through to get confirmed. And frankly, the attention you draw and the wonderful world of information technology also has produced bloggers and all sorts of people who, in order to gain market share in a particular television network, go after public officials, perhaps unfairly from time to time. Wouldn't you agree, Rupert?
It depends which media you're talking about, yes.
Well, I was, Now that the general has brought this up, I was tempted, Rupert, but I decided not to. But I think there are probably a lot of people in this room who say that there are people who work for you who are already working for the administration. On that note, I want to thank you all. Leave it at that. Lee Scott, Rupert Murdoch, General Powell, Carlos Slim, thank you all very much. Let me just say one word. I really believe that these are seismic shifts of enormous importance. I spent a lot of time in the Third World, and I spent a lot of time in the underclass in this country. And we can't leave it to these companies and to these gentlemen alone. This kind of work requires foot soldiers, and it's not enough just to come to breakfast once a year at the Clinton Initiative. It means that we all have to make a commitment in some form, and I hope that you've seen here today that there are lots of rewards for that kind of commitment that go beyond the bottom line. So thank you all very much for this chance to talk about it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the plenary session is now concluded. Your working sessions will begin at 9:30.